Good morning. As I said in my email yesterday, I much prefer starting series than finishing them. Because when I start, I still have a whole world of hope that is just like a blank canvas. And it's like, oh, I can share this, I can do that. And when you come near to the end, I'm just struck by all the things we didn't do with the book of Daniel. And there are quite a few. As those of you who have been through this sort of thing before, you'll see that I've painted the book of Daniel with very large brushstrokes as opposed to going to the detail. If you want the detail and you want to see it in a sort of sermon presentation format, the Amazing Facts website, if you search for Daniel in any chapter in their search box, not in Google, in their own search box, they have a video presentation on each of the chapters, each of the prophecy chapters. So Daniel 7, 8, 9, and on. And they have about 50 minutes of detail there. And there's different presenters for each one, and they all run out of time because Daniel is loaded with information. I mean, it really, really is packed in there. But I've opted more in a sermon setting to go for the big themes of the book. And I think you'll see that again today as we tackle Daniel 10 and 11. And 12, we've kind of been doing throughout the book, and we did that on the first week. Daniel 12 is a chapter that says that this is the book for the end times. Even in Daniel 10, it says this is for the future. So that theme carries throughout the whole book, and I live on the premise that we are the most end times people that have ever lived on the face of this earth. That I have serious confidence in saying. I don't know if I'm the last generation. And whenever I see preachers get up and say, look what happened in the news, it's starting right now, I've got this cynical side in me that goes, you've been saying that for generations. And I try to forgive myself for that, and I seek forgiveness for that, because one day it is going to be the last generation. If Daniel tells us anything, it's that this world as we know it with sin is going to end. There is a line drawn in the sand where God says, enough. We have seen sin for what it is and what it will do. Now we can get rid of it. So that's kind of the big theme we've been working on throughout the whole thing. And I would like to actually perhaps go over... Oh, I need to turn this on. That always helps. Go over some of the things that we have done throughout the book. I'm just going to do a quick recap. Because if you're going to do that, you're probably going to do that on the last week. I would say, too, that I have enjoyed this series. It's been good for me because I've had to study Daniel in a way that I haven't probably since college. And if you do have questions about the details and wish we'd gone a little more into what the three ribs are, et cetera, and things like that, who is the king of the north, who is the king of the south, we'll talk a little bit about that today, do come see me. And there are some pretty good prophecy people in and amongst our congregation as well. And it's kind of fun to share it. And if you would like to, you know, lead some of the details of it and have a midweek meeting or a Friday evening meeting, my sense is there are some people here that would be quite willing to be part of that. So if you're feeling the call on you to teach a little bit, and some of you certainly have that, come see me too. All right, courage. Sometimes people get awarded for their courageousness pretty much because they were at the right place at the right time. The airline pilot that landed his airplane on the Hudson River in New York, he is known to be very courageous. Well, every other airline pilot in the world is like, God, I'd have given that a go. You know, I mean, when you fly airplanes and you lose everything, this is time to fly. He was in the right place at the right time, and he obviously had the skills. But sometimes I think that courage is more about people who walk into a situation knowing and fully aware of what they are giving up to serve or be in this particular place. So at the bottom here, risking injury to help someone in need, I think is courageous. Someone else has a need. I can supply that need. So I'm going to go out of my comfortable place into this, you know, unknown place, and I am going to help this. This might be someone right down in town. It might be someone broken down at the side of the road who might be there just to trick someone into stopping and then steal all your stuff. Okay, that goes through my head. But you do it because you feel the call of God on that, and you go. The next one up, standing for truth despite the consequences. Maybe you know something to be right, and despite what you know will happen because of your stand, you stand anyway. And that's courage. The next one up, doing what's right against all odds. I think we've kind of covered that. Living for God no matter what. So by these definitions of courage, I believe that Daniel and his three friends were tremendously courageous. On multiple occasions, they lived exactly what they believed because they knew that they believed it more than they were afraid of what might come their particular way. And if we want to serve God in some meaningful and significant way, it often won't take off until we start bringing some courage into the mix. If church is boring for you, you might have to do something courageous. Next Sabbath, we're going to have, I think we've got 10 of you that are all going to be sitting up here, and you're going to give a 2 to 3 minute response to what the resurrection of Jesus Christ means to you. And on the worship committee, we have gone to people who typically might not be asked to do that. And what I've heard over, I don't do public speaking. But I know that the 10 people who come and do it will probably get more out of that message than they have out of the 20 or 30 that have already come. But it will take some courage. And maybe you feel a call to be to share your faith somewhere or with someone. And that's going to take courage. You don't know their response. But once you do, your relationship with God will be anything but boring. It becomes sort of intense. So, over the last few weeks, since the second week of January, we've been going through various chapters of Daniel. So, chapter 1, we had the two laden tables up here, one with a feast, perhaps from the time of Daniel, and one with a feast of things that we might sort of rely on and use today to sort of get through life and to make us feel special and powerful and all those things. And the conclusion, the main theme out of that sermon that we were trying to share together was, if we are to hear what God is going to say, we must start with what He has already said. Sometimes we have huge hope, even expectation, that God will share information with us, all the while we're completely ignoring what He's already shared with us. And Daniel and his three friends were someone that, in a new setting, in a new place, were very willing and even eager to rely on what God had already said. And through that, God was able to use them to share even more in the coming times. The next week, we went to Daniel chapter 2. And I said, it's all just a phase. Anything that you're going through right now, if it's good, you don't really need to hear this so much. But if it's painful, if it's tragic in some way, it's just a phase. It will end. It might seem like forever, but it will end. God is in control. He has the plan. And so we were introduced to the first image from the book of Daniel, and it showed all these kingdoms, with the only one that lasts forever is God's kingdom. And that came from the dream given to Nebuchadnezzar. Then chapter 3, which is known for the fiery furnace and the golden image, Nebuchadnezzar's response to that, the original dream, he wanted to make his own kingdom forever. We came up with the line, it's better to follow God to death than make your own ways, your own alternative rules up. And this is hard, because sometimes it's really easy to dodge something coming towards you and sort of forget about God's instruction. But Daniel and his three friends were prepared to go to death rather than give up what God was calling them to do. Then chapters 4 and 5 we did together, and we said that you are part of God's plan. We talked about Nebuchadnezzar becoming like a beast out in the field, and then Belshazzar as a king not submitting his will to God. Nebuchadnezzar did submit his will to God by the end. So we talked about God's patience, God's call on our lives. But again, there is an end. There is a time when decisions have to be made. And for us, it's probably when we die. Otherwise, it's when Jesus comes back to claim his own. And then chapter 6 and 7 I put together. This was Daniel's lion's den experience, and then our first dive into some serious biblical prophecy. We said Daniel follows God's laws always. But not everybody who claims to speak for God will do that. And I, who work in a religious and for a religious institution, am probably aware as much as anyone how sometimes, in order to protect our assets, the mission of the gospel sometimes has to be laid aside for a little while. And I don't think it should be. I think God's people should have the courage to lose everything, but keep God's precepts, keep his laws. And then Daniel chapter 8, which is, you know, Adventist chapter, verse 14, 2300 days. This is kind of a big deal. We said God is still in the saving business and will save you and will forgive you and will cleanse you. That is his process. That's what he's calling you to. And if you come to Jesus, that is what he offers. And we also went through some of the timeline things that Daniel 8 might be suggesting and telling God's people there. And then last week, we finally talked about the promised Messiah. Because Daniel, I believe, was missing that. He was a good Jewish boy, and he would have been waiting for the Messiah to come set up his kingdom. But all this information that he's seeing has nothing to do with that. And we get an incredibly detailed prophecy highlighting his baptism, his crucifixion, and gives us a starting point for all the prophecies that we look at through there. So now I'm going to come to Daniel 11, 10, 11, that for me go together, as we wrap up this series of Daniel before we'll do something else starting next week and the weeks after. If you were driving through Merced on Thursday evening after most people got off of work, and you were trying to go between, 15th Street and 13th Street, there was a big old train in your way. Anybody get stopped by that train in here? Yeah, I met David. It was just sitting there, and I was sitting there too, for a really long time. And then the cars in front of me turned around and went away, and I crept up, and just like, well, down there, I see cars crossing. So I went down and managed to get across and went to Home Depot to sort of beef up in the flower department in my house. I had promised myself that if I wrote this sermon, I could do that. Something like that. And while I was there, David and I met. And we were talking quite a long time. And at the end, we both said, well, you know what? The train must have gone by now. It hadn't, had it? No, we would not have been able to believe that. What had happened, a man appearing in his early 50s tried to cross the railway tracks. He looked inebriated. He looked like he was drunk, and he just wasn't hearing anything, including people trying to warn him that there was a train coming. And those trains don't come quietly. But he crossed the tracks, and the train hit him. And he died right on our street there. And that's why the train pulled to a stop way up the track. But that's what happened right in the middle of our town on Thursday. When you come to railway crossings and you're behind a tanker that carries some flammable material, have you noticed that they always come to a full stop? If you're behind a bus, school bus, city bus, anyone that carries a serious amount of, could carry a serious amount of people on it, that vehicle has to come to a complete stop. If it's a bus, it has to open the door, which it can only do when it's stopped, close the door, and then it can move on. The reason we do this is because there have been tremendous casualties when a train hits a bus. In my mind, I cannot understand how that happens. I mean, those lights, those barriers, they give you plenty of warning. But it does. And so the idea of making these explosive or highly populated vehicles stop is to try and prevent a terrible tragedy on a massive scale. When I was younger and I lived in England, some of you might remember this, England was kind of known, amongst other things, thankfully, for their soccer hooliganism. We had some serious problems where people would take like pool balls, you know, when you play pool, they take the balls for that, high up and like throw them down on the opposing fans. In Italy, someone took a moped up to the top and threw that on top of the fans. I don't know how you smuggle a moped into a soccer game. But they would fight with each other. They'd storm the pitch. People would die. Sometimes many people. So we had a solution. We decided that we would put caging up so that opposing fans can't run into each other. And we thought this was a great idea. And they were serious cages, because when you got 200 people doing this, you can do some amazing things. Just to let you know, some Napoli fans from the Napoli soccer teams south of Rome in Italy, they managed to tip a train carriage over that way. So a group of people working together can do some pretty fierce stuff. So we put cages not only between the fans, but also between the fans and the soccer pitch, so that they couldn't run onto the soccer pitch. They would be contained. No one ever thought that this was a terrible idea. This was a great idea. This will save lives. Well, unfortunately, in April 1989, on a Saturday, at a big semi-final, it was England, had a big game on. The sun went down. I watched the recap show. And as I turned it on, I learned that at the beginning of that soccer match, the officials had sent too many people into one of those cages. And the match started, and all those trying to get in wanted to make sure they got in to see. And 96 people died being crushed against those cages. 800 were injured. So we took the cages down. Thankfully, we didn't implement one of the ideas, and that was to run electricity through those cages to stop them from doing that. Now there's no cages. We had to try something else. And there's no soccer hooliganism, in case you want. Well, there's pockets of it here and there, but not usually in the stadium. On 9/11, we decided, well, just after 9/11, as a result of the terrorist attacks, we decided that planes needed very lockable doors, impenetrable doors. Why? Because the terrorists had come into the cockpit and had taken over control. And we're like, we can solve that problem. Let's make those doors so hard no one can get through it. And so every single passenger airline in the world above a certain size has these impenetrable doors so that no one can disturb the captain and the co-pilot. If you are watching the news this week, you know where I'm going with this. A depressed man, it seems, suffering from pretty severe depression, waited until the pilot left the cockpit, probably to use the restroom. And then he locked that door and began an 8-minute descent into the French-Italian Alps. No one could get into that door. Again, our solutions very often become our problems. We are fantastic at solving an issue that has just happened. As human beings, we are terrible at trying to predict what will happen. I mean, we predict it. We know this could happen. But we decide, because, you know, the passenger's peace of mind is really what the problem is, we decide that we can't do it because it costs too much money or it's too awkward. This week, on Thursday, all the major European airlines said, we will now make sure there are two people in the cockpit at all times. Again, that's a wonderful idea 5 days ago. We knew this could happen. This is not a trick. But the will of the people just didn't see it. So we'd have argued it over in our law-making bodies and go, well, no, we don't need that. And of course, we're safe. But once everybody's looking at one thing, then we'll fix something that just happened rather than look ahead. Now, when Daniel is seeing this vision now, he just sees a world that's starting to tear apart. And he sees all these issues and all these problems and these things that are going to destroy kingdoms, are going to make kingdoms. And it just gets harder and harder and harder and worse to see. And he comes up with just, I have this picture of this guy, he's like, ah, this is crazy. People can't solve anything. People can't make anything safe, can't get a kingdom to last, can't bring peace to the world. And Daniel even saw that his own people, the Israelites, also could not do that. Daniel was beginning to discover that, oh no, the new world order is not going to be ushered in through God's people. And this was such big news for Daniel, because Daniel grew up believing that they were God's people, that they should follow God's ways so that the world could see God through them as a nation. But Daniel was seeing more and more that that was not going to be the case all the way through Earth's history. And so Daniel was with a group of people. And we get this in Daniel chapter 10. He's with a group of people. In fact, I'm going to go to Daniel 10 because I'm going to read some of the verses right here. Daniel chapter 10 and verse 2. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning for 3 weeks. I ate no delicacies, no meat or wine entered my mouth. Which when I read that, I'm thinking, oh, so it did it other times then, huh? Yeah, maybe that's what I see right there. Nor did I anoint myself at all, which is Daniel speak for I didn't use deodorant. Which, right? Which meant that he probably did other times, which is good. On the 24th day of the first month, that's April 23, someone worked that out for me. I was standing on the bank of the great river, that's the Tigris, and I lifted my eyes, and I looked, and behold, a man clothed in linen with a belt of fine gold around his waist. His body was like a beryl. His face, the beryl is like a, a transparent, yellowy, greeny mineral. His face like the appearance of lightning. His eyes like flaming torches. His arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze. And the sound of his words like the sound of a multitude. Now, when Daniel sees this and when he hears it, he turns his face. He can't look at it. And it says that he cannot respond to the words that this being is saying. He is literally dumbfounded. He has lost all of his strength. He goes pale. He's weak. And this is what often happens when we start coming into the presence of God in some way. Something I've noticed when I feel like I'm into the presence of God, sometimes it happens in this room. Not every week. It's not an automatic thing for me. I'd like to think that it was. It happens sometimes in the big cathedrals of Europe, which I always visit when I go over there. Sometimes it's in the mountains. But when I feel the presence of God or the closeness of God, I never have any anxiety. I mean, none. Maybe that's what the presence of God is to me, is the absence of anxiety. But I also sometimes feel like I don't really know what to do next. Or I'm overwhelmed that there's so much to do that I can't do it. And these are the things that Daniel experienced a lot. And then another created being comes over and starts talking to Daniel and touches Daniel. And strength starts coming back to Daniel. And this being says, I'm going to show you more things that happen to your people. And so we get to Daniel chapter 11, where we are introduced to the vision of the kings of the north and the kings of the south. Now, I'm going to paint in some big brushstrokes here, because I'll tell you, I don't know the details of this chapter. Now, first of all, this is an incredibly fun chapter for us, because we as a denomination, as a group of people, we don't know for sure what the interpretation of this chapter is. Now, if you get Adventist commentaries and read them and all that, it will give an explanation. But there's a lot of Adventist theologians now that don't agree with that explanation, because we're beginning to think that maybe when this church first formed, when we first started studying Daniel, that the events possibly of Daniel 11 may not even have happened yet. So if you often wish that you could have lived back in a time when they were exploring the Bible and seeing these things come to life and learning them for the first time, well, guess what? You can study Daniel 11 and have that experience. Because, you know, 40, 50 years ago, we used to, you know, come and tell you what Daniel said. And if there was a preacher that thought something different, he usually found out it was time to get another job somewhere. I'm so thankful that's not the case anymore. We have realized we don't know everything, and we want pastors and churches and people around to be the kind of people that study the Bible to find out what it says, not reinforce some sort of church dogma. So in my experience, with people that I hang out, there are people that believe that everything in Daniel 11 has happened already. And there are people that believe in Daniel 11 is still yet to come. And there are people that believe that some of it's happened, some of it is happening, and some of it will happen, which is kind of where I fall in this. So I'm going to paint some big brushstrokes and talk about the kings of the north and the kings of the south. And the first thing I want us to note, and this is important, and it might seem kind of obvious, but it needs to be said. These kings are plural. This is not one king. It's not even one kingdom, actually, as I understand it. This is a thought, a way of life, a set of values that perpetrate an area that comes out of kingdom after kingdom after kingdom. Because kingdoms spawn kingdoms, cultures spawn cultures, especially once they start traveling around the world. So first of all, we've got the kings of the north and we've got the kings of the south. And this is a huge deal in Daniel 11. Because these kings are constantly doing battle over a period of time. It doesn't say exactly how much time. I think it's quite a bit of time. Sometimes they even get along if they decide it's in their good cause. There are periods that are mentioned in Daniel 11 where they even make a pact and work together for a while. But as soon as it doesn't work for one, they rise up against the other. Now, there's something I want to point out as we do this. Kings of the South, Kings of the North. This would have been written and given in Babylon, Iraq, just a few miles south of Baghdad. And around the known world at that point. There's something I want us to see I'm not going to read the whole chapter, it would take too long, and I wouldn't even follow it myself. There's just so many details. But as you go home and read this, there's a few things I want to keep in your mind that might help you as you start reading this. Let me put a map up here. Here comes the kings of the south. As far as they know, that would have been Egypt, Libya, across the coast over there, maybe even into Saudi Arabia and across that way. Then you got the kings of the north, which would have been what we know as Europe today, coming through the area of Turkey, coming down even up as far as probably even Russia. What is in the middle of these two kingdoms? It's Israel. They are situated right in the middle. Now, if you read Daniel chapter 10, you'll see that Daniel is about to find out what is going to happen to his people. And that is part of the context that Daniel 11 is going to need to be kept in. So here we have Israel right in the middle of these kingdoms. And of course, now it's not just Israel, it's Jerusalem. Jerusalem is this city which is so important to Christians, to Jews, and to Islam. Now, this is what is confusing us now, because our first interpretations of Daniel didn't include Islam at all. I mean, just wasn't even a factor where we were studying this book. It wasn't even something that we were thinking about. There's a lot of people that think, and seeing what's going on in the world right now, and think, well, something that big, if we think this book is for the end times, shouldn't that show up? Well, if it does, it's in Daniel 11. But I've left scripture right now. I'm trying to just do something that, you know, we sort of lay on the top and we see how it fits. There's a guy called Tim Rosenberg who is spending his whole entire life in ministry on Daniel 11 right now. He came to camp meeting a couple of years ago. He got me excited about prophecy once again, because he had a very good attitude about it, saying, you know, we might not know, but this is what we do know. And he studied this chapter over and over. He does sort of see every time something happens in the world that is religion caused or based, he'll write an email and comment on it based on Daniel 11. But right now, just a few things that I want you to notice that are happening right there. Jerusalem is kind of in the middle and at the center of all this. But Daniel will notice again, it's just more and more bad news for Daniel. It's not a power. It's just a battleground. It's a focal point. Israel isn't determining, actually, I might have to take some of that back. But these kings of the north and kings of the south, they're going to do battle. They're going to come through Israel. Though it does also talk about ships at one point. They could have perhaps gone a little bit more direct. Something else that I wanted to show you from the map that we just saw that I think is kind of a big deal. It certainly is to me. But the kings of the north, the kingdoms of the north, and we would know them as the west now, generally keep Sunday as their holy day, right? The kingdoms of the south generally keep Friday as their holy day. Again, there is a middle ground. We know it, you know, especially in this church, through God's people, we know it as the Sabbath. Now, if you've ever been around Adventist churches for a long time, Adventist churches have taught and preached for years and years, that there's going to become a Sunday law. When I started growing up, having heard this for years and years and years, I wanted to see where that very specific thing is in the Bible. And it was not as clear as I expected it to be. I think it's there, but as with a lot of prophecy, you have to kind of put a few pieces together. It's like some mystery movie, and we get to play the part of the hero that's discovering different things everywhere. But the danger of that is you can put the wrong pieces together and come to the wrong conclusion really easily. So we do have to be careful, and I think we need to respect each other and learn from each other, especially if we have an interest in this sort of area. But here, if you've got the kings of the north against the kings of the south, if this is to turn into what Daniel 11 seems to be talking, that it will turn into, there are a group of people that are going to get caught in the middle. It's a group of people that aren't going to keep Sunday, that are going to keep dietary laws. Who does that? Adventists do. And the kingdoms of the south do. We might not look like we're on the right side. It's possible. These are some of the things that I look through. We maybe have a discussion in a room somewhere if you want to know a little bit more about this. Something else I want to bring up that I've seen, and that is in the kingdoms of the north or the west, we've become a very secularized society. And the word political correctness has come to be kind of a dirty word for a lot of people, because it's like sin doesn't really have sin's no big deal. As long as you keep it to yourself for a while, and if it's not hurting anybody, well, let's just sort of carry on and do that. And I've heard a lot of people, preachers in Christian churches, talk about the dangers of political correctness. But if you go to the other extreme of that, where if you live in a place, you have to abide by a certain set of rules, and if you don't, or even if we think you don't, and you're a woman that we think did the wrong thing going to the wrong place, well, then we are going to beat you until you are dead. That's what I would call extremism. And I see these two ways of life taking a hold on certain sets of society. Again, in the middle of that, there is a middle ground. I would call it love, the kind of love that God died to demonstrate, the type of love that God's people are called to use in their ministry, in their daily lives, in their daily living. This idea of love. It's the only way that you can actually deal with the problems of extremism and the problems of political correctness. Love will win both those arguments every single time. So going back to how I started about how we're just terrible at solving the world's problems. Here we are. The kings of the south trying one thing. The kings of the north trying other things. Some of them talking blasphemous things about God, claiming to say things that God is saying that He's not really saying. We've tried so many things to make this world work. We've tried socialism. We've tried fascism. We've tried communism. We've tried capitalism. And nothing works for this whole entire world. It is beyond our abilities to solve. We have energy crises. We have moral crises. Excuse me. Oh, that sounded fun if you're listening with your headphones on. Excuse me. But none of it is really working. We look at murderers. We look at thieves. We look at adulterers. We look at all these people that break the set of rules in our society. And we accuse and we judge and we deem that you are wrong. And we come up and we pronounce punishment and we lock the dissidents away to try and keep some sort of semblance of order in our world, trying to protect what we have so that nobody else can get it, trying to make our lives worth living and beautiful and right. And when somebody doesn't, we'll cut them off and put them away. So whether there are things on the left or things on the right, things from the south or things from the north, I once again want to call you, this church, to look at the man in the middle. Because the man in the middle is the one who will solve everything that sin has caused. And that is where the hope lies. So if you do nothing, follow the man in the middle. Yes, he was killed, but he rose again. And he will come back to set up his kingdom. A kingdom which will last forever. A kingdom that in its breadth and scope will give you the kind of freedom to be the person that God created you to be. So if you're going through anything right now, it is just a phase. These kingdoms, these ways of life will fall away, and our Savior Jesus Christ will come and will take his people home to live forever and ever and ever. And Daniel, that includes your people and your ways. Spend some time with your Savior, will you, for the next 2 to 3 minutes. Button. We can turn that down. It's just starting again. Oh, I'm really sorry about that. They got me yesterday when I was there. The good news is it's not the end of our service today. It almost is. But I want to make the end of this service our own and invite you to sing once more a song we've been singing throughout the whole time. This world is not my home. I'm just a passing through. And I invite you to stand and just sing this. And because I had so much fun on the bass earlier, I'm going to go do that again. So sing with some joy.
Feel at home in this world anymore.